some dark. All right, well, what I tried to do in that first part really is just introduce and lay the foundation for what we're going to talk about in the second part. The second part, from a Christian standpoint, is what really is interesting. And what we'll get to in this part is, why did the Essenes believe that the battle with the Romans was the final apocalyptic battle? I mean, it seems kind of arbitrary, and you know, if you don't really understand what these people believed and did, you kind of think they're crazy. You know, these guys are crazy. They withdraw from civilization, go live in the desert, and await the appearance of the Messiah. I mean, why do that? Well, there's a very specific reason they did that that's rooted in the Old Testament. And that's what we're going to get into here first. But I've got another video clip I'm going to start here just to get things started. So when everybody's about ready, I'll hit play here.
Jerusalem today strains at the close of the 20th century with the voices of many faiths. The differing voices within Judaism worship at the same wall. Different Christians come as pilgrims to this hallowed ground, each proclaiming the way of Christ. Muslims worship as they have for centuries at the Dome of the Rock. Scholars variously as the Covenanters, the Essenes, the Yahad, and the Sons of Light, as the desert community defined themselves, they also lived in a time and place of many voices. Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and other groups all claimed to be the true Israel. Judaism was evolving from this rich tapestry of voices that pitched Jews against each other in a spiritual battle for souls. The Sons of Light emerged from this world and followed their leaders out of the chaos of 2nd century BCE Jerusalem to the purity of the desert and the peace that it offered. In their flight to the desert to establish a new order, they could not have known that they were living in a world that was in the throes of giving birth to Rabbinic Judaism and Christianity as we know them today.
This was a period of tremendous religious ferment, 3rd, 2nd, 1st centuries BCE in Judaism from Second Temple time. But there were all kinds of other trends as well, like strong apocalyptic, messianic trends. And these feed to some extent into Christianity, to some extent into rebellious groups within Judaism who rebel against Rome twice. And we have a kind of sorting out of traditions at this time in which some parts of Second Temple Judaism end up sort of flowing into Rabbinic Judaism. And some other elements end up flowing into Christianity. And some other elements just sort of die off the scene. But it's a very complex set of developments which lead to the religious picture that we know of once we emerge into the early centuries of this era.
Departing Jerusalem, the Sons of Light also left behind the sacred temple. This temple, in the eyes of the Sons of Light, had been defiled, and therefore could not serve the truly righteous of Israel.
And so what happened was that the members of the Qumran community basically felt that that temple was not being run right, because of Hellenistic influence on the high priests, various other specific rituals that they disagreed with. So they withdrew from it. And for them, the dream of a perfect temple that they would return to and that would be run the way they thought it should be run was perhaps the greatest of all dreams.
Propelled by visions of a new temple, these men forged a sacred community out of the desert on the shores of the Dead Sea to achieve their final destiny. The lowest place on Earth at 1,300 feet below sea level, the Dead Sea has a salt content 7 to 8 times that of the world's oceans, and it evaporates at a rate of 55 inches a year, often creating a thick, heavy stench in the air. Along the shoreline, gravel terraces indicate recent levels of the inland sea. Less than 2 inches of rain falls on this desolate land in any given year. Temperatures hover above 100 degrees Fahrenheit for days on end during the long summer. Life has always had a tenuous foothold here in the Judean desert. Sons of Light belonged to a group in antiquity known as the Essenes, a group that was dedicated to strict observance of religious doctrine from dawn through the night. The main complex was used for study, worship, and the communal meals that were served during the day. It is likely that the Sons of Light slept in the caves of the nearby cliffs and in tents around the sacred building, only entering into the East Gate after 2 years of initiation and probation. This building separated the Sons of Light from the rest of the world.
They were separatists, and they separated themselves from the general community. They were pietists, and most scholars believe that the sect of the Dead Sea Scrolls is Essene.
One manuscript found in the caves, the Community Rule, details the daily rituals of the Sons of Light and underscores their complete devotion to God.
Before I move my hands and feet, I will bless his name. I will praise him before I go out or enter, or sit or rise.
Each brother was pledged to a strict code of conduct that reinforced the sanctity of a place where angels tread and prayer was constant. Even simple murmuring was met with swift justice. On this, the rules of the community were clear.
Whoever has murmured against the authority of the community shall be expelled.
It was a tough regime, far removed from later Christianity and other religions preaching compassion for the weak and sick. But within this rigid community was the belief that their piety and purity led to a higher dimension.
Too much care for the last part of that clip, but I included it in order to make this point. A lot of scholarship on the Dead Sea Scrolls treats the Essenes as if they're rigid and harsh, like he was just talking about. But think about what he just said. They had a rule against murmuring and spreading dissension in the community, and anybody who does that insists on continuing it is going to be disinvited from the community. Well, I mean, in order to really have peace and unity in any organization, you've got to have that kind of policy. In fact, there's even some words in the New Testament about opposing murmuring and dissension and, you know, spreading discontent and stuff among the brethren. And that kind of policy has nothing to do with whether we're willing or not willing to show compassion to the weak and the sick, you know. And he was kind of placing those two attitudes in conflict when really they're not. I mean, all the Essenes were trying to do is what modern Christian churches try to do, and that's maintain a healthy peace and unity among the community. And if anybody starts murmuring and spreading dissension, that's going to create a problem, you know? So I just like to point that out because I think these guys get a bad rap with a lot of modern scholarship that doesn't really understand what it means to be in a community that's attempting to be godly, right? I mean, you have a community of brothers and sisters in the Lord, and we're all trying to be faithful here. I mean, you just can't have murmuring and dissension. And the Essenes were no different on that point. They followed the law of Moses and the community rule, as I said before, not as an external show like the Pharisees, but as an expression of authentic faith and love for one another. So every reason to think these people are compassionate towards the weak and the sick. In fact, Moses has lots of commandments about that. You got to treat the poor and the sick with compassion. You got to be generous. In fact, love your neighbor as yourself was not original with Jesus. Moses says stuff like that. The prophets say stuff like that. And these guys knew that. So the parallels with the Christian church, you know, on these points and other related points, have been noticed from the first discoveries of the Dead Sea Scrolls. A lot of people even have argued that the Dead Sea Scrolls were written or at least heavily influenced by Christians. For this reason, and the fact that they talk about the Messiah as the Son of God and so forth, today we strictly associate with Christianity. But you can see from the Dead Sea Scrolls the messianism, their belief in a Messiah, their apocalypticism, meaning their belief in the end of the world and the coming final judgment and the war of God against evil in the world, the emphasis on the importance of community and covenant. We're covenanting together. Baptism, holiness, scripture, simplicity of life, opposition to the world and to the corruption of Judaism at the time of Jesus, love for the temple, and the longing for a new temple. All of this stuff came to be characteristic of Christianity, but it was characteristic of faithful Jews before it was characteristic of Christianity. In fact, the Qumran Yahad even referred to themselves as covenanters, like Reformed Presbyterians have done since the beginning. You read about the history of Reformed Presbyterians going all the way back into the Scottish and Northern Irish roots. They talk about themselves as covenanters. The Scottish League and Covenant, right? The Great League and Covenant. The parallels with the early church are even more obvious because of the Jewishness of the early church. Remember, the Jesus' disciples were all Jewish. The early converts were all Jewish. Paul was a Jew. But eventually, as time went on, the Christian church became more and more Gentile as the word went out to the nations. And now, you know, a group of 40 of us in the middle of Gentileville, Gentile land, are talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls and, you know, a Jewish Messiah, and we're reading a Bible that's written by Jews, both Old and New Testaments, and Christianity in many ways is a very Jewish phenomenon. In fact, if you remember the great Presbyterian apologist from the 70s and 80s, Francis Schaeffer, 60s, 70s, and 80s, I guess, he had a wife named Edith, who also was an author in her own right. She has a great book called Christianity is Jewish. And I recommend that book if you happen to stumble across it. She's got some great thoughts on the Jewish roots of Christianity and how we worship the Jewish Messiah. Like I said before, this led some scholars to assume Qumran has been influenced or even founded by Christians. And, you know, the scrolls may mention Jesus and this sort of thing. None of that is really valid. I mean, it isn't. It's a Jewish movement that produced these scrolls. And I'm going to show you Schiffman again here in just a real quick one-minute clip where he makes a very important point along these lines. And it's more powerful coming from a Jewish guy than from a Gentile like me.
Now, I have been arguing for years that you cannot understand the scrolls properly unless you get away from this notion of seeing it all in light of later Christianity. I am going to argue in a book that I hope will be finished in a year or two, but maybe not, that the scrolls, once understood in that way, have much more to say about Christianity than the way in which it was done before. I made a kind of nasty formulation of that once that somebody didn't like and asked me not to print, but I'll repeat it anyhow, which was that whoever steals the scrolls from the Jewish people steals them also from the Christians. Because the true meaning of the scrolls for the history of Christianity is in reconstructing the Judaism before and understanding that certain tendencies which we used to think were not Jewish are Jewish. And that is the case with this type of contemporizing interpretation. We now realize that it was prominent among some Jews at this time. Whereas from Talmudic sources, one would have thought that it was really a very minor player in the world of biblical interpretation.
So did you follow what he said there? What he's saying is, if you Christianize the scrolls and try to turn them into some type of Christian phenomenon, not only are you not really being honest with the evidence, which all points to Judaism, but you're really doing a disservice to Christianity, because the real value in this is in upholding the arguments of the early Christian apologists in the first centuries of the church, people like Irenaeus and other early church fathers that were constantly engaged in disputes with the Jews who refused to believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And Irenaeus and others basically said, look, everything we're doing in the Christian church has Jewish roots, right? I mean, we haven't like invented something new here. What we've done is take the Old Testament, looked at Psalm 2 and Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53 and the promise of the new covenant and Jeremiah 31 and all these other fantastic Old Testament Hebrew Bible passages that are perfectly fulfilled in Jesus of Nazareth. So what he just said, I think, makes the point beautifully, in a way that really points out the truth that the early Christians were right about the Jewish roots of Christianity, and the Jewish opponents of the early Christians were in fact wrong. If you think back to the New Testament, the Jewish opposition to Christianity goes back to Jesus, who's constantly engaged in a battle with the Jewish leaders, to the crucifixion of Jesus, which was in large part stimulated by the Jewish leadership, to the persecution of Paul with the Jews chasing him all around the Mediterranean, and it extended into the later Christian centuries. One of Irenaeus' great writings is called Against the Jews. And he's not against the Jews as a people group. He's against their arguments that undermine the legitimacy of the arguments for Christ as the Messiah. So this comes down to the present day, and we're going to build on this and get to what is really the nub around Jewish rejection of Jesus here in a minute. But I first want to show you a clip on how the Essenes practice baptism that will remind you in many ways of the way Christians practice water baptism. So take a look at this.
To be among the angels, the sons of light had to be pure in heart and body, and water became the key to purification for the sons of light. Through an elaborate system of aqueducts, the water from the Judean hills was channeled into cisterns and baths built by the community at Qumran. It is ironic, given the fact that only 2 inches of rain falls here annually, that much of this water was dedicated to ritual purposes. At the so-called fifth hour of each day, the community would return from their labors to eat in common. Before eating, they purified themselves.
They would have to come in and put a loincloth on, take off their work clothes and put it over to the side, come down on these steps, and go down to the level where the water had settled to, or evaporated to, immerse themselves, come back up on the other side,
to walk in the steps of the Qumranites is like walking back in time. The most important part of the main complex was the scriptorium, the place where scrolls were copied or written, and the rooms where the scrolls were studied. No doubt the sect had a large collection of scrolls to read from, some of historical significance, such as copies of older biblical texts, but also those containing the harsh rules for their daily lives.
Again, he's talking about harsh rules that really, if you look at them, a lot of them are just common sense. But more importantly, on the issue of baptism, one of the reasons why baptism became such an important rite in Christian churches is because of the ministry of John the Baptist. Now, if you read the Gospels and you're sort of, you know, you're new to the Bible, especially if you're new to the Bible, you come to the Gospels and this character, John the Baptist, sort of appears at the beginning, almost seemingly out of nowhere. The angel, in the first chapter of Luke's Gospel, the angel appears to Zacharias, who's a priest. In fact, he's from the high priestly line of Aaron. And he's in the temple, and the angel appears to him, and he says, you're going to have a son. And Zacharias is advanced in age, and so is his wife, who's also a daughter of Aaron, by the way. And the angel says, well, since you didn't believe me, you're going to be mute and not be able to talk until John the Baptist is born. And after John the Baptist is born, they named him John. Zacharias can talk again, and he gives this great song or prophecy about the greatness of the Lord and the great things that John the Baptist is going to do. And then Luke says, in what appears to be a strange anticlimax, he was in the deserts until the day he was manifested to Israel. And you're kind of like, whoa, what just happened here? This guy's born to a high priest of Israel. His mother is also from the line of Aaron, meaning, by the way, John the Baptist is a high priest of Israel. Very important point that's often not recognized about John the Baptist. John the Baptist is a high Levitical priest. Whether he's in the desert or in the temple, he's a high priest because he's descended from Aaron. But what was in the deserts? Why'd he go into the deserts? Well, the Essenes were in the deserts. And remember, the Essenes are largely priests. They're not all priests, but they're largely priests. Contemporary rabbinic accounts even call them avenging priests in the temple, which is a very powerful image of a righteous priest cleansing a corrupt temple, a la Jesus. That's a theme we could talk about for, you know, several hours all by itself. But John clearly seems to have been associated with these guys, unless he was just in the deserts all by himself, which seems pretty unlikely, especially since the Gospels say that all of Jerusalem and Judea went out to John to be baptized. And it's like, well, why would they have done that unless they had a category for John, right? I mean, they knew what type of guy this was. He was one of these Essenes. Except, he's talking about one coming after me who's mightier than I and whose sandals I am not worthy to loose, and he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit. His winnowing fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly clean out his threshing floor. John was like a bolt out of heaven at that point. And he did not dress like the Essenes. That's kind of an interesting angle. He did not dress like the Essenes when he was baptizing. He dressed like Elijah. 2 Kings 1 says, the king asked them, what kind of man was it who came to meet you and told you this? They replied, he had a garment of hair and a leather belt around his waist. Talking about Elijah. And what John is doing as one of these Essenes is coming out into the desert, proclaiming baptism, like the Essenes practice, dressed like Elijah. So if you're someone in Second Temple Israel and you're trying to figure out what's going on, that's what you look at this character, John the Baptist, and you understand he's an Essene, but he's trying to be Elijah. And he's calling the nation to repentance, just like Elijah did, proclaiming a baptism. Okay? Preparing the way of the Lord. That was the mission of John the Baptist. Make straight the way of the Lord. And when Jesus finally came, John says, what? He must increase and I must decrease. He's greater than I. I'm not worthy to carry his sandals. No, I'm not the Messiah. The Gospels say he confessed. He did not deny. He confessed. I'm not the Messiah. But all Israel was going out to him, and so, you know, he could have very easily claimed to be the Messiah himself. He didn't. And so the ministry of John the Baptist ends up coloring the whole New Testament, even where he's not mentioned specifically. The fact that Jesus has all these crowds following him is in part because of Jesus' own ministry, but it's also partly in God's providence because John the Baptist had prepared the way for him. So I think this is one aspect of the New Testament where the Essenes and the whole Dead Sea Scrolls phenomenon kind of fills in some gaps and really helps us understand who was John the Baptist, why did God send him, what were the providential arrangements so that John could become the new Elijah. Remember, the Old Testament closes, the book of Malachi, the Old Testament closes with the words, behold, I will send you Elijah before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the children to the fathers and the hearts of the fathers to their children, lest I strike the earth with a curse. Last words of the book of Malachi. And then John shows up looking like Elijah. So it all holds together if viewed from a Christian perspective, with the Essenes understood not as a Christian movement, but as a precursor, a Jewish precursor to the rise of Christianity. Hopefully that's clear. Now, I got a clip coming up here on how Brigham Young used technology to map the various connections between the communities in the Judean desert. So check this out.
But these ancient ruins take on a new meaning when seen through the eyes of the space age. Synthetic Aperture Radar, SAR for short, is designed to read the Earth's surface even when obscured by dense cloud cover. Today's Israel and Palestine can be seen in detail, and physical features are enhanced by the satellite technology. But the amazing feature of this technology is that it allows us to see beyond the observations of the naked eye. It can actually work as a time machine and allow us to glance back into history. BYU scientists David Long and David Arnold teamed up to create a smaller version of NASA's SAR that promises to shed light on how the Sons of Light lived on the shore of the Dead Sea.
This is a custom-designed antenna we built. The overall system operates at about 2 gigahertz. This is a patched phased array antenna. It's a very flat panel. Kind of innovative, but not something that a lot of places couldn't do. This one's unusual that we did it here so that we could get students involved with it, and it's a very broad band.
These scientists and students worked to deploy this backyard SAR equipment at a fraction of the cost of the NASA space model to capture microwave images of the ruins of Qumran and other sites in Israel from a small plane.
What we'd hope to get, we'd hope that optically you see colors of the ground. But at radar frequencies, where your wavelengths are more like this now, you'll see roughnesses on the ground of that scale. So you'll see rocks of that size. So our hope is that we can see foundations that were buried because the ground will come up, or old fences, or piles of rock. And we'd, for instance, from the air, we'd be able to see designs, maybe to see how the city was laid out. So that would give a survey for an archaeologist to begin their excavation plans for when they actually go and excavate the site.
The first attempt with the new technology had everyone excited. Mounting the radar device under the small plane was the easy part. The whole system will be operated from the inside of the plane using computers. On the ground, a number of metal cones are deployed to form a grid on which the photographs will be aligned. The flight route is carefully mapped out, as they need to fly as low and level to the surface of the ground as possible to get the best reading.
One of the questions is how big was the civilization? Was it just where Qumran is, or was it the whole shelf around the Dead Sea there? So we hope to be able to see, trails, ancient trails going between different settlements, so we can get an idea of how large that civilization or that segment, its population was.
Doug Thompson collects data as they fly over the site. At this stage, he has no visual control of the images the system captures. Only later, in the lab, will he be able to analyze the material. The first flyover at Qumran was marred by turbulence, which scattered the images of the site in the trails and the sand. But other flyovers in the Holy Land proved the technology could work to pinpoint ancient trails and structures not visible to the naked eye. But it's already clear that the Qumran site was a place well connected with nearby communities such as Jericho, Ain Feshka, and Ain Gwara.
If I was one of the group 2,000 years ago, I was given the map of the country, I would say this is the place. Because it has all the advantages. It has the seclusion. I mean, real seclusion. You have to remember that the road that you see now hasn't existed at that time. And the water reached the cliffs, so there was not even a trail going along the coast there. So this is a real seclusion on the one hand. On the other hand, it's one day's walk to Jerusalem. One day's walk to Jerusalem, it's a couple of hours to Jericho. So they're far from civilization, but not too far from civilization.
All right, so I got a map here to maybe help you get a little bit better handle on the geography around these sites. Here's Qumran. Jericho's up here. And remember, when the Jews came out of Egypt, Moses led them around here. Moses died over here somewhere. Joshua took them across the Jordan and conquered Jericho. All right, but Jericho appears to have been a site that the Essenes liked and formed a community there, partly because Jericho is like a little oasis in the desert up here, and maybe they weren't in the city, but were outside the city and went to Jericho, much the same way the Qumran people went to Jerusalem, which is over here, to get their supplies and parchments and whatever else they needed. Wadi Murabbat is down here. Engedi, I've already mentioned, as being a major Essene site. Nahal Haver down here, and of course, Masada, which is one of the most famous sites in Jerusalem, or in Israel, in Judea. When I went to Israel back in 1997, We toured Masada. It's still, you can see the ruins there. It was obviously occupied by a group very much like these Essenes, if not Essene itself. When the Romans besieged Judea, Masada was one of the very last sites that they conquered. And the reason they were able to do that is because Masada is very tall. It's like basically a mountaintop that these guys were on. And it's extremely difficult to besiege if you're the attacking party. So some of these Essenes, and maybe some other Jews who maybe weren't identified as Essenes but joined the rebellion, made their last stand at the top of Masada and then eventually all committed suicide when they saw their hope was lost. So one of the reasons why these groups chose the Dead Sea area is because the hills that run on the west side of the Dead Sea here have springs in them, and occasionally it rains too. It doesn't rain much, but it does rain. And when that happens, in addition to the spring water that comes out of these springs, it flows down into the Dead Sea. So in all these sites on the west bank of the Dead Sea, you can get water. In the way that previous clip that showed baptism and drinking water, of course, is the first necessity. But once you have drinking water, you also need baptism water when you're one of these Essenes. Now, I've got one more clip that explains what happened at the end to these Essene groups. And then we'll bring the whole thing to a climax. So we're getting close to done. I've got about 5 or 6 more slides after this clip.
Another ceramic object found at Qumran 40 years ago has held its secrets well. Cosmic secrets about the alignment of heavenly time with earthly time. Only recently, Stephen Fahn identified the object as a sundial.
The historical significance of this sundial, when it was modified in its final form, is that it's the only timepiece in antiquity which accurately determined the fifth hour of the day any time during the year.
As the sun rose in the morning over the Dead Sea, the sundial was calibrated to mark the hours of the day, regardless of the season. It was common at the time, not only in Qumran, to divide the day between sunrise and sunset in 12 equal hours. The length of each hour of the day would thus change according to the season. They would be shorter in the winter and longer in the summer. Divided into 3 watches, sunrise, noon, or the fifth hour, and sunset. And the importance was to find the fifth hour, the exact time when they had their meal at the site, and when they aligned themselves with heaven. The true alignment with heaven culminated in the final appointed battle between the sons of light and the sons of darkness.
They were expecting war like that for, I believe, at least 2 centuries. They took it that seriously. One of the reasons they went to the desert is to prepare themselves for that kind of war. They prepare themselves in purity, and you name it, and even compose a book about how the war is going to be handled. Because the war of the children of light against the children of darkness is exactly a military manual.
On the points of the javelin they shall write, shining javelin of the power of God. Bloody spikes to bring down the slain by the wrath of God. Flaming blade to devour the wicked struck down by the judgment of God. One 1,000 men rank 7 lines deep. They shall each hold shields of bronze, burnished with mirrors.
The sons of light waited more than 200 years in the desert for this holy war. What signs they were waiting for is unknown. But when the Roman army was mobilized to curb the Jewish rebellion, they believed the day had come. The historian Josephus tells us of the fate of the Essenes at the hands of the Romans.
The war with the Romans tried their souls through and through by every variety of test, racked and twisted, burned and broken, and made to pass through every instrument of torture in order to induce them to blaspheme their lawgiver. Smiling in their agony, disciples and mildly deriding their tormentors, they cheerfully resigned their souls, confident that they would receive them back again.
The Jewish revolt was an ironic end to the apocalyptic vision of the Sons of Light, for it was the Romans who had a dizzying array of weapons and legions of men.
Well, they took their revolt against the Romans too seriously. They believed that this is the apocalyptic war they were expecting. So they entered the war with abandon. So much so that they perished in the war. They were just killed on the battlefields, and after the battles, they were hunted down by the Romans and butchered. And how do they know the fact that we have 800 scrolls? I mean, there was nobody to retrieve it.
Although there is no archaeological evidence of a final courageous battle close to Qumran, it is certain the Sons of Light vanished, a footnote in history to the Roman conquest of Judea.
The scattered remnants of the Qumran group would have sort of melted in along with a whole variety of Second Temple groups that disappear off the face of the earth, so to speak, as a result of the consensus which takes place around Pharisaic Rabbinic Judaism after the destruction.
Whatever happened, a dream was shattered.
At first, they didn't think of staying more than a few months, maybe a few years at most, and they were planning to come back and purify the temple. And they died there with some regrets, since they were expecting the Messiah and hoped to come back to Jerusalem.
Dreams and visions that drove these men into the wilderness are not yet fully understood. It is the science of the 21st century that will bring us closer to these forgotten voices in the desert.
In this area, there are quite a number of artificial caves that caved in, that crumbled. We believe that there might have been even 20. The fact that they are crumbled is an advantage because they haven't been rifled. Nobody disturbed them if they have crumbled at the right time. So there is a very good possibility that if we will dig those caves, we will find utensils and, God willing, even manuscripts, even Dead Sea Scrolls.
Though lost in the aftermath of the Roman military campaign, the voices of Qumran can once again be heard because of the painstaking work of dozens of scientists and scholars around the world. But for every question answered, many others are being asked, and perhaps many answers still lie hidden in the desert. In many ways, the real work on the Dead Sea Scrolls is just beginning.
So that was how things ended for the Essenes, and really it was a Roman apocalypse of sorts. The Romans knew that these guys were zealous Jews, and they knew the roots of the revolt that started in 68 AD lay in these Essene communities, which is why they cleaned them out, including Qumran, Masada, En-Gedi, and all those other sites I showed you on the map, when they invaded Judea starting in 68, finishing in 70, with the destruction of the temple. In many ways, the persecution of the Essenes parallels that of the Christians, except the early Christians did not resist militarily like the Essenes did. It's true that some Essenes may not have resisted militarily. It's not obvious that all of them joined the revolt. But in general, the War Scroll and some other writings makes it pretty clear that these guys believe that the final apocalyptic battle was upon them with the invasion of the Romans. Now, the book of Revelation was also written in the context of Roman rule, and it's clear that the early Christians understood the Roman context as being, in many ways, a kind of apocalyptic sort of thing, and I'm going to show you why. I'm going to show you why the Christians thought that and why the Essenes thought that from the book of Daniel. All right? Now follow me here, because I'm going to show you a couple of passages in Daniel that led these people to believe that the invasion of the Romans was the last step before the appearance of Messiah. Okay? Now, Daniel had predicted the rise of the Medo-Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans after the Babylonians. All right? Remember, Daniel lived during the time of the Babylonians, King Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar sees a vision, and Daniel's got to interpret the dream, right? The vision is of the giant man with the head of gold and the upper body of silver, the midriff of bronze and the legs of iron, and the feet of iron and clay, mixed iron and clay, all right? Now here's Daniel's interpretation in part of that vision. The fourth kingdom, referring to the legs of iron, and appearing to be the Romans, because he later names the Medo-Persians and the Greeks as being the second and the third kingdoms that follow the Babylonians. The fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. Like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It, the kingdom of God, shall break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So it looks like four earthly kingdoms and then Messiah comes. Alright? Now look at Daniel 7 where he says basically the same thing. Four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast. So again, he's talking about the fourth beast. Dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. All peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. It shall not pass away, and his kingdom one which shall not be destroyed. So if you're like a devout Jew reading Daniel, you know about the Babylonians, the Medo-Persians, and the Greeks, and now here come the Romans. All right, now look at Daniel chapter 8. Remember this sequence. Babylonians, Medo-Persians, Greeks, Romans, Messiah. Daniel 8. And he said, look, this is an angel speaking to Daniel. The angel says to Daniel, look, I am making known to you what shall happen in the latter time of the indignation. For at the appointed time the end will be. The ram which you saw having two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia, Medo-Persians. And the male goat who comes after the ram is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that's between its eyes is the first king. As for the broken horn and the four that stood up in its place, four kingdoms shall arise out of that nation, but not with its power. A reference to the breaking up of the Greek kingdom of Alexander the Great into four tetrarchies. Well-known event in history, Daniel predicted it precisely. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features who understands sinister schemes. Through his cunning, he will cause deceit to prosper under his rule. He will exalt himself in his heart. He'll destroy many in their prosperity. He'll even rise against the prince of princes. Oh, so the prince of princes is now on the scene. But he, the fourth beast, shall be broken without human means, presumably by the prince of princes. So again, you have this four kingdoms, and then the Messiah comes. One final one, one of the most famous prophecies in the Old Testament, Daniel's 70 weeks. Alright, follow me here. 70 weeks are determined from Daniel 9. 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city. To finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, even the wall, in troublesome times. Now, a week is commonly understood, this is not controversial, as a poetic reference to 7 years. So 69 weeks times 7 years is 483 years. Okay? Now, the command to build Jerusalem was issued, according to Ezra 7, in the 7th year of Artaxerxes. Ezra says, Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, a scribe of the law of God and of heaven, perfect peace and so forth, I issue a decree that all those of the people of Israel and the priests and Levites in my realm who volunteer to go up to Jerusalem may go with you. That is the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. The consensus dates for the reign of Artaxerxes are 465 BC to 424 BC, thereabouts. Those dates aren't gospel, but that's roughly what we're talking about here. So if the reign of Artaxerxes started in 465, the 7th year of his reign is 458, that's when the decree is issued, and when the Essenes, this is the key point, When the Essenes withdrew into the desert in 150 BC, they believed less than 200 years remained until Messiah, according to Daniel. I went through that fast, but did you follow that? Daniel says Babylonians, Medo-Persians, Greeks, then Messiah. And from the point, from the decree that goes forth to rebuild Jerusalem, 69 weeks, namely 483 years, until Messiah the Prince. These guys knew all this. I mean, they knew Daniel well. Okay? This is why, as Broshi was just saying, the former curator of the Shrine of the Book, and why the narrator in that clip was saying, we don't know why these guys withdrew into the desert. It seems kind of strange. Their motivations are still unknown, and we need modern science to help us figure all this stuff out. Well, if you know your Bible, like the Essenes did, and like Christians should too, this explains a whole lot. And when they withdrew into the desert in 150 BC and wrote that letter to the temple establishment, less than 200 years remained, and by the time the Romans invaded, that 200 years was up now. They thought Messiah was coming, based on Daniel. Now, they missed something very important, of course. And I'm going to show you what the Essenes missed and what the Christians didn't miss, and why the Christians did not make the same mistake that the Essenes made in trying to resist the Romans militarily, a battle they had no hope of winning. Okay? Unless, you know, some apocalyptic revelation did happen, and it didn't happen, at least in the way they expected it. Daniel 2, these are the words. The words not in bold are the words I just quoted to you. The fourth kingdom, strong as iron, iron breaks in pieces, iron crushes, so on and so forth. The bold here, I excluded from the previous quote. All right? Here's what Daniel says in addition. Whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom, namely the fourth kingdom, shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it. Just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay, the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with clay, they will mingle with the seed of men, namely the fourth kingdom, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. Very mysterious statement here. And in that day, the kingdom, in those days, the kings of God, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which doesn't perish and last forever, and so on and so forth. My point just in this quote is there's this whole part here about the fourth kingdom breaking apart, and there's iron and clay, and they don't adhere together, and what does that mean? All right, now let's look at Daniel chapter 7. Again, the bold here I didn't include in the prior quote. Prior quote about the four beasts, and the fourth one has iron teeth, and he's devouring and breaking pieces and trampling and so forth. Daniel then says, the fourth was different from all the beasts that were before it. It had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up from among them, before whom three of the first were plucked out by the roots. And in this horn, the one horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So Daniel's talking about the saints being persecuted and even defeated by this fourth kingdom. And then, until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. So, in this Daniel 7 passage, yeah, the fourth beast comes, and then the kingdom of God comes, but in between, there's some other stuff going on that seemed to indicate the good guys lose for a while. Right? All right, now look at Daniel 8. This is going to get increasingly clear, I think. Again, all this is from before. The kings of Media and Persia, the male goats, the kingdom of Greece, the ram is the kings of Media and Persia, the goat is the kingdom of Greece, the large horn is the first king, and it breaks up into four pieces, and then another kingdom comes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty and also the holy people. Confirming what he said in chapter 7 about the holy people are destined for some losses and persecution. And then, through his cunning, he will cause deceit to prosper and so forth. And then he'll rise against the prince of princes who will break him without human means. And then, just interesting note here, Daniel says at the end of this prophecy in chapter 8, "And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick for days." This vision was extremely, however he got it, was extremely powerful and overwhelming to him. Alright, and this is the climax of the whole thing, alright? So follow me here. What the Essenes missed and the Christians didn't about Daniel's prophecy of 70 weeks and the coming of the Messiah. Daniel 9. 70 weeks are determined for your people in the holy city. That whole thing I read before. Seal up the vision and prophecy. Anoint the most holy. Build Jerusalem. From the decree that goes forth to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there'll be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street will be built and the wall, even in troublesome times. Remember when Nehemiah built the wall of Jerusalem? It was troublesome times. That's what the book of Nehemiah is about. All right, then Daniel says this. "And after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself." So not only will the fourth kingdom prevail against the holy people, the saints, he's going to prevail against Messiah. Messiah's going to be cut off, according to Daniel. But not for himself, Daniel makes clear. It's not, the Messiah will not be cut off because of anything he did, right? "And the people of the prince who is to come," namely the fourth kingdom, "shall destroy the city and the sanctuary." But Daniel had predicted the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Now, here's why the Essenes missed that. I alluded to this earlier. They did not accept the idea of a suffering Messiah. They simply could not accept the idea of a suffering Messiah. And this comes across in the New Testament when Jesus is talking to his disciples. Simon Peter asks him, "Lord, is now the time? Are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel?" And Jesus is saying, "I have a cup I have to drink." James and John want to be seated, you know, on either side of him at the king, in the kingdom, right hand and left. And Jesus says, "Can you drink the cup that I have to drink?" Now, he does also refer to himself as the Son of Man regularly, making clear that he is indeed the one Daniel was talking about. That's why Jesus loves this term, Son of Man. In fact, talks about him himself as the Son of Man way more frequently than he talks about himself as the Son of God. He loves this term. There's lots that's been written about this. Why does Jesus love the Son of Man, the term Son of Man, so much? "You will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of glory, or the clouds of heaven with great glory, and he will send his angels to gather the elect from the four winds." Well, he's making clear that I am the one Daniel predicted. And he came after the fourth kingdom, just as Daniel had predicted. The key part that the Essenes missed, though, was after the 62 weeks, which comes after the 7 weeks, total 69 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, and the prince of the people who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. Now, remember, a week is a poetic reference to 7 years. 69 weeks times 7 is 483 years total. The command to build Jerusalem was issued in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, according to Ezra. The consensus dates for the reign of Artaxerxes, again, are 465 to 424, which are not gospel. These dates could easily be off by a decade in one direction or the other, right? This is just sort of the best consensus number that modern scholars can come to. But say that number is 457 instead of 465. All right? So the reign of Artaxerxes begins in 457. The 7th year of his reign, as Ezra says, would then be 450 BC. Exactly 69 weeks before the crucifixion of Jesus in or about 33 AD. Did you see that? 450 BC plus 33 AD is 483 years to the year. Now, my point here is not to argue that Jesus was definitely crucified in 33 AD. That day, you know, the dating of that is technical, and we have to get down in the weeds to really have an opinion on that. Same with this beginning of the reign of Artaxerxes. But my own personal opinion, and this is widespread in evangelical Bible scholarship, is that whenever Jesus was crucified, the 7th year of the reign of Artaxerxes, when that decree was issued, is exactly 483 years prior. And this is the meaning of Daniel's 69 weeks. From the time that the decree goes forth to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah is cut off is exactly 69 weeks. Now, that's what the Essenes missed because they rejected a suffering Messiah, and what the Christians didn't miss. They recognized that Messiah was coming after Daniel's fourth kingdom, the Romans, but that he first had to be cut off before he came in conquering victory. And that, to this day, is the difference between Jews and Christians. Jews will not... One main reason they will not accept Christ as the Messiah is, A, he's nobody from nowhere, right? Joseph and Mary claim to be descended from David, and so that makes Jesus descended from David, they claim. But, I mean, they're nobody, and most importantly, Jesus was crucified like a common criminal by the Romans. How does that amount to messianic salvation for the Jewish nation? Right? Which they contributed to, right, yeah. But you can, you know, from a human standpoint, you can see how the Jews are analyzing this and just not seeing it. Paul says a veil lies over the Jewish eyes, and he prays for the Jews and hopes that God will open their eyes and so forth. But all the New Testament is very much around this controversy between Jews and Christians that persists to this day. So, to summarize this, this sequence here is very important for understanding the Essenes and the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's also important for understanding Christianity and the history of the world from a biblical standpoint. Now, you may be wondering, what happened to Daniel's 70th week? We only talk about 69 weeks, and the prophecy talks about 70. And this is a source of major controversy in the history of Christianity, and it has to do with Christian eschatology and how the book of Revelation fulfills Daniel's 70th week. A whole bunch of stuff has been written on this, and we don't have time to get into it, and it would open a whole can of worms that I don't want to open, all right? I'm just going to summarize it for you here. Remember, Daniel says the fourth kingdom breaks apart into iron and clay, and it kind of holds together. The strength of the iron's in it, but not really, because iron and clay don't really mix and they don't really adhere. But what is all that? The holy ones and the saints are cut off. Messiah himself is cut off. That part there is pretty clear if we're talking about the crucifixion of Jesus. But who and what are the iron and clay? When is the 70th week? Where does the church fit in? And what happens now? Is what sort of we're left wondering about Daniel's 70th week, in which the book of Revelation, in very mysterious fashion, picks up. Daniel and Revelation are very closely connected. Many people have recognized that. In fact, G.K. Beale, who's a great Presbyterian Bible scholar, I think he's at Westminster in Philadelphia, if I'm not mistaken. He might be out at Westminster in Escondido, California. He's written a book called The Use of Daniel in the Apocalypse of St. John. If you're interested in this topic, that's a great resource to pick up. G.K. Beale, B-E-A-L-E, The Use of Daniel in the Apocalypse of St. John. He takes up, you know, all these various questions and tries to put them together. But my point here for helping us understand the Dead Sea Scrolls and ultimately Christianity is just this. The tragedy of the Essenes is that the Messiah appeared precisely when they expected him. Just let that sit on you for a while. These guys go out into the desert trying to make a way for the Lord, and then he comes, and you have John the Baptist, and you have Simon the Zealot, and possibly a few other of Jesus' disciples. I didn't have time to get into the bit about Andrew, but Andrew, John's gospel makes clear, was a disciple of John the Baptist before he was a disciple of Jesus. And Andrew was probably also influenced by the Essenes, and Simon Peter, his brother, tends to act in such a way, like cutting off the high priest's ear, like the gentleman mentioned during the break, seems to, you know, that feels like a zealous Jewish thing to do, right? You're cutting off the servant, not the high priest's ear, but the servant of the high priest, because he's attacking the Messiah. all kinds of great, rich meaning there. But the Messiah appeared precisely when they expected him, and many of them missed him. They were indeed chosen by God for the role they played in helping to bring about John the Baptist, helping to bring about some of the apostles of Jesus, helping to bring about the baptism of Jesus. The whole movement that was John the Baptist preparing the way of the Lord when he did appear. I mean, clearly the Essenes were part of this. And clearly there was a purpose of God in the abiding unwillingness of Jews to accept the suffering Messiah. That bit about a suffering Messiah, God inserting that part in the plan, has had a huge impact on the way history is unfolded, the way Judaism unfolded, the way Christianity unfolded. Just impossible to overstate how much the importance, or impossible to overstate how important the idea of a suffering Messiah is. Not least because that's how atonement happened. That's how our sins got forgiven. Right? I mean,
he laid down his
life that everyone who believes in him may be called a child of God, a son or daughter of God, a suffering Messiah. Isaiah 53, Psalm 22, which describes crucifixion almost. The word crucifixion is not used in Psalm 22, I don't think. But it's, you know, they cast lots for my garment. They're circled around me like dogs. You know, all this very vivid imagery of persecution that's even the Jews recognized was messianic. The most faithful Jews did. Tragedy of the Essenes. They were the most faithful people in Israel until the rise of the church. Clearly more faithful than the Sadducees, who didn't even believe in the resurrection. Clearly more faithful than the Pharisees, who were worried about how far you bent over when you prayed, you know, because that's how you show how godly you are. I mean, these guys weren't into any of that. I mean, they were into Daniel and the appearance of the Messiah and the restoration of the kingdom and the separation of the good from evil, final separation, as in final judgment. So my argument, sort of the crux of my whole presentation, is the value of the Dead Sea Scrolls for understanding pre-Christian Israel, Second Temple Judaism, and the meaning and the life of Christ is enormous. I hope you're convinced of that. I hope you've learned something. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. And if we want to do a little discussion and Q&A, we can certainly do that. I can stay around as long as you guys want to stay, but I know it's late, so feel free to hit the high road if, you know, if the sidewalk's going to roll up on you. Thank you very much. Oh, by the way, if you're interested in reading the Dead Sea Scrolls for yourself, and you want to see what the War Scroll says, what the Temple Scroll says, or whatever, here's a great resource. If you go to Amazon.com, here, you can hear me typing it into my computer, and you type in Dead Sea Scrolls, what comes up is this book right here, The Complete Dead Sea Scrolls in English, edited by Giza Ramesh, who's a major Jewish scholar, had a huge influence on Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship. Everything that's currently known for less than $10. Actually, $10.70 if you, you know.
What's the name?
The name, I'm sorry, is The Complete Dead Sea Scrolls in English.
The author
is Giza, G-E-Z-A, Ramesh, V-E-R, M as in Mary, E-S. Giza Ramesh. He's now deceased, but great Dead Sea Scroll scholar, same league as Emmanuel Tove. This is sort of the leading one volume, everything in one place, if you want to read it, and it's cheap, $10. So, thank you very much, and Q&A, and again, if you get up and leave, I won't be offended in the least. I know people got stuff to do, and the sidewalk rolls up.
10 o'clock at night is late.
Sorry?
10 o'clock at night is late.
Just once. How many times? Is that what you asked? Yeah. Yeah. As well. I hope to get back there again. This one. The Garden Tomb?
Yes. Beautiful place.